degrees. From WVUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Suicide bombers, the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, the widening war on terror, and just last week in New Hampshire, teenage boys, good students, and best friends pleading guilty to the senseless murders of two Dartmouth College professors. The world these days can feel bizarre and threatening, and adults aren't the only ones who feel that way, so do children. Ever since the terrorist attacks of September 11th, whether they say so or not, America's kids are looking for answers and reassurance that somehow things are going to be okay. That is a tall order for parents. Conventional wisdom about trust and humanity often feels inadequate to explain the world these days. So how should parents talk to children about the tough topics in the news? Tonight's guest, psychologist and author Mike Riera, says the bottom line is that parents have to let kids have information about the real world without robbing them of their childhood. There are real dangers in telling kids too much too soon, he says, and equal danger in turning teens cynical or nihilistic if we don't address real moral issues. Parents, the doctor is in to answer your questions. What are your kids asking you about the news and its implications? What are you telling them? Do your responses feel adequate? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from Berkeley, California is Michael Riera, co-author of the new book, Right from Wrong, Instilling a Sense of Integrity in Your Child. He's written extensively on raising and understanding teenagers. Good evening and welcome, Michael Riera.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Michael Riera, how much more difficult is it in these last 6 months to deal with children than usual?
Well, it's always difficult to deal with children, but I think it's gotten even more so, in part because as parents, we almost have to become amateur psychologists to understand what's going on with them. For instance, when there is this kind of emotion in the air, and kids are amazing, they do pick up on it in their parents, even if no words are being used back and forth. Kids tend to regress. And as parents, we need to understand that, you know, when your six-year-old who has moved on to her own bed and is fine and everything for the last couple of years, All of a sudden September 11th happens and they feel the fear in the air, all of a sudden they want to come back into your bed. They want to find that old teddy bear. So parents are having to juggle a few things beyond the norm right now.
You know, it seems like welcoming a six-year-old back into the bed would be the easy part, a small price to pay, the sort of easy thing to deal with. But we see all these giant issues, and not just in parents' emotions, but in global emotion, in global events, in outbursts of hatred and death and violence and suicide. I guess the sort of starting point question that I've got here is, these days, with all this going on, can children, and we'll have to talk about different ages, but can children be well-informed about this crazy world and still have a healthy, normal childhood?
I think the short answer is yes, but the key phrase there is well-informed. You know, a six-year-old, well-informed for a six-year-old is very different than for a 12-year-old and very different than from an 18-year-old. And one of the mistakes I think we can make is to give kids too much information. You know, when they ask the question, what, and this is a real, it sounds easy, but it's very difficult to do, you just want to answer the question they're asking. When we start to give too much information, they get overloaded. So,
what are the consequences of overload?
The consequences of overload, I think you can have kids start to act out. Younger kids will act out. Older kids will get cynical, and they're not going to engage with what's going on. So I think we have, and a sign of the conversation's going well is they ask a question, you answer it, and then there's silence for a little while. And then they mull it over. Sometimes the kids walk away at that point, only to come back an hour later or the next day and ask the next question, and you answer that question.
Dad, Mom, why did 9/11 happen? What's enough and what's too much?
I think that, what age are we saying?
Oh, midpoint, I guess, 10.
Say 10 years old. I think we sit down and say, I don't know why it happened. And then we turn it back to them. Why do you think it happened? What have you heard people saying? And now they're going to tell you where they are in the process. And they'll say, well, you know, my teacher said it was people who hate the United States. And my friend said it was someone, people who wanted to become famous. And you can listen to everything they have to say, and you want to pull it out of them to find out where they are. And then you come in with your own opinion. Well, no one really knows why, except it was a terrible thing to have happen.
And yet, sometimes I wonder if that's enough. I wonder if they don't want to know something deeper about their parents' view of what's going on when the events are so traumatic. I want to just put the question out to our listeners. The question is, what questions are your kids asking that stump you? What do you want to tell your kids that you don't know how to say? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. How about it, Michael Riera? Are there times when you've got to step up with and fill in the blanks a little more?
Yeah, you do have to step up and fill the blanks, but also don't be afraid to say, I don't know. This is scaring me too. You know, we're going to be, I mean, it's the old bumper sticker. Think globally, act locally. And it's with the family, is that we're going to talk about these things with our kids. But the extent that we talk about them being out of our control, we're not sure what's going to happen, we need to reassure them in our home. So it may be that that's the night that you go out to dinner together, or you do the ritual that you do together. So as much as you bring these other emotions and these doubt and these fears into the family that are legitimate, that are there in the world, that we name for our kids, we also need to reassure them by our behaviors and our presence at home.
Let's tick the age up a little bit then, and because I'm curious, when you get into the teenage realm, in your view, a teenager wants to understand suicide bombers. What would make someone do that? Am I to turn and reply to a 16-year-old, I don't know, what do you think?
Well, I think you can actually turn to them and say, you know, there's lots of reasons. What do you imagine first? And let them talk for a while. You know, teenagers, you know, to the shock of parents, a lot of time they don't want to know what we think. They want us to listen to what they have to think.
So it's an opening gambit. It's a way for them to get a conversation started to share with the parent.
Exactly. I mean, how many teenagers come up and say, Mom, Dad, such and such is going on. What do you think I should do? And as soon as you start to open your mouth, their eyes roll back in their head and they walk away because they really want you to turn it back to them and ask them what they should do. So we do the same thing. We also have to have our own answer, that when you live in a world of doubt, sometimes what you want to do is take the world that's gray in front of you and make it black and white. And suicide bombers do that. They make the world black and white. They have a very clear path. They do it, and they think it's going to bring them fame and bring honor to their family. We can't shy away from telling the kids the answers, but we also want to find out where they sit with it.
Let's take another tough one that goes straight to this issue of trust, and really trust of adults and authority figures, I guess, and that's the crisis that we've seen in the Catholic Church in the last several months around child sex abuse. Again, I guess it's different for different ages, but take us through a range. How do you deal with that with a 7-year-old? How do you deal with it with a 10? How about with a teenager?
Well, I think one of the things to remember is paramount is our children's safety. And what we have to be talking to them about is, in any situation they get in that's uncomfortable, how they would get themselves out of it. I mean, that's first and foremost. So with a 7-year-old,
sort of logistical, tactical game plan
absolutely.
For if you feel threatened.
And there has to be not only the logistical game plan, there has to be a little bit of practice. So you might say to your 7-year-old, if someone touched you in a way that felt uncomfortable, what would you do? What would you say? And then have them actually say the words aloud. Who would you tell about this? How would you bring it up with that person? So that it's all worked out in their head ahead of time, and all they have to do now is bring the plan and make use of it. That's key. Then I think we can talk to them about, you have to trust, you have to get to know people on your own. Just because they're a priest, or just because they're a policeman, or just because they're a teacher, or just because they're a doctor, doesn't mean you can trust them automatically. People have to earn your trust. Then we turn it back to them again and say, how do people earn your trust? How do you know you can trust people? And it's always surprising that even at age 7, they've got some pretty sophisticated answers to this question.
But Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in an era when even figures who are supposed to be paragons of trust, let's say a priest, are under suspicion. And this is just one difficult angle today. But it's not just trusting individuals. It's the whole issue of trust and whether trust is a reasonable sentiment that comes into question. Might it not be, Jack?
it might well be. And yet, you know, just listening to what the doctor was saying, if more parents had said to their children, say, when these abuses by the priest had talked to them about safety and had actually surfaced some of these things, maybe some of this abuse wouldn't have happened. I mean, there's an effectiveness here that maybe this scandal will sort of put paid to this kind of thing, not just among priests, but will surface the thing generally, so that what looks like a crisis in authority, and which really is, could also be an opportunity in the real world and perhaps even with children to legitimate authority. So the priest, you wouldn't have to fear priests, and you wouldn't have to fear the teacher. And in other words, it could become a moment for self-criticism on the part of adults. Society toward the reformation of institutions like the priesthood.
It could. We wonder how much kids take on board with that. Parents, what's the right balance of protecting innocence and raising responsible world citizens? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Aliza's on the line. Welcome, Aliza. You're on the air.
Hello. This is very close to me because my ex-husband, my 12-year-old's father, is a policeman in Israel. And he recently called at, it was 7 a.m. our time, I picked up the phone and he said, I shot one of the terrorists. And he wanted to tell my son. And I said, well, okay, I'll let him know you called. And I hung up and he called back later and my son answered the phone and he told him. And he...
How old is your son?
12.
How did he take this news?
Well, I think he sort of... was very, he didn't really know at first how to react, and then he was sort of proud of him because he felt, well, he shot a bad guy, so it's okay. And I think he told a few people close to him that he knew, but then he stopped talking about it, and it went away, and he didn't deal with it again.
Aliza, hang on. I want to put this to Mike Riera. Mike,
sure.
This makes it totally personal.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a conflict going on globally, and Aliza's had to deal with it. Right in her lap, right, and it's her husband, it's her son. What do you think of this sequence of events, Mike?
I think Aliza's in a really tough position because, especially with Dad not being in the house, he's in another country. This information is, is overload for a 12-year-old, and he did what most 12-year-olds would do. He sort of sat with it. Talked to a few kids and then went underground with it. And the thing is, what Aliza has to do is you have to start bringing the topic back up with him. So it may be a few days down the road and you say, you know, Stephen, have you thought any more about what your dad said? You got any questions about it? Because, and this is where we become transparent with our kids. And again, not overloading them, saying, you know, I heard your father say this and, boy, it shocks me, and I know he's a policeman over there, and I know he has to do his duty and that he's fight terrorism, but to hear the details of it, that was really surprising. And how have other kids reacted to this? Because you've got to keep this, in a strange way, sort of alive for him so that he's wrestling with it, because the danger is that a kid turns this into black and white and then has to side with his dad or against his dad on everything like this and has to take, you know, the almost the martyr rooted home, saying, you know, that all the terrorists are evil and is not open to hearing any of the gray areas.
Or otherwise he's rejecting his own father. Aliza,
yeah.
do you feel your son still wrestling with it, Aliza?
He sort of hasn't brought it up and it's sort of gone away. He tucked it in and, you know, hasn't talked about it. But my question is why, and, like, at home we teach killing is wrong. Hurting someone else is wrong. So when is it okay, and who, you know, why is it okay in this case, and whose side is right? I mean, there are two people have legitimate, you know, fighting going on, and why is it okay for one to kill the other? That's what the hard thing is, I think.
That is a tough one.
To explain.
That's the hard one for the adults.
Whether it's an ex-husband or whether it's a whole nation, what about that, Mike Greer? And Aliza, thank you so much for your call. What about this notion? One party is wronged or feels wronged and strikes back, whether it's a military or an individual who's part of a police force. How are children to see that?
Well, I think these questions are the essential questions. These are the questions adults are wrestling with, and at 12 or 13 years old, it's probably not too early for them to wrestle with some of these. I would say one of the things, a very practical matter, is You have conversations with your kid one-on-one. I think it also makes use sometimes to bring the topic up, the general topic, not the specifics of what his father did in this situation, mm-hmm. but the general topic up when his friends are around also. And you get to hear sort of the developmental level of how other kids are understanding it.
They can all chime in.
And one of the things I think is important is sort of jumping in there and asking the question that's not being asked so that they have to take on a new perspective and try it from another way.
Mike Riera, stand by. We've got a break. We'll come right back
sure.
to it. We're talking about talking to our kids in difficult times. There are a lot of thorny issues to explain. What's the right balance of protecting innocence and raising responsible world citizens? What questions are your kids asking that stump you? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about talking to our children about the incredible and impossible array of issues that have been laid out in the last 6 or 8 months. Do you worry that your kids can't even ask what they want, what they need to know? And have you ever seen a 6-month stretch with so many horrible events to explain? What do you want to tell your kids that you don't even know how to say? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Mike Riera. He's a psychologist who's lectured around the country on parenting teenagers. He's co-author most currently of Right from Wrong, Instilling a Sense of Integrity in Your Child. Fern is on the line. Welcome, Fern. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just had a comment about the topic of information overload.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the author of a book called Terrorism and Kids, Comforting Your Child, which came out since 9/11. And there's been a lot of research done about the issue of television watching and children around the issue of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree that there's an overload risk here?
I absolutely agree there's an overload. In fact, I wanted to say that parents should be especially careful of how much TV their children are watching. There was a recent article in New England Journal of Medicine that reported that the levels of fear in children rose directly in proportion to how much television they watched on and right after 9/11.
Well, let's talk about that directly, Mike Riera, and stay on the line, Fern. But, Mike, what is the right amount of information? We don't want to hide our children from the realities of the world. It'll only, common sense would say it'll only be harder later in that case. But take us through a couple of age levels, 2 or 3, and describe to us how much is enough, how much is too much.
Well, I think Fern is right on here, is that kids don't need to see these images over and over again. You know, probably most kids up to about 7 or 8 can see the images one time with an adult there so that they've got a visual to it. But you don't want them seeing it any more than that, because what happens is without the adult there, it just stimulates the fear and it runs out of control after a while. As kids get older, I would say 8 to 12, you want to let them watch sparingly, but you want to be with them as much as you possibly can. I think it's appropriate sometimes to say when you've got the news on and they walk in and there's something from September 11th showing, is that you just to turn the TV off and say, you know, if we've watched enough of this, let's turn and talk to one another for a while. And then as they get older, unfortunately, you know, it's really tough to monitor them. And, I think when kids get 13, 14, 15, 16, like that, one of the things is we can do is speak to them about the effects of television, you know. And the way we always begin with teenagers is with ourselves, you know. When I watch television, I find that I get a little pessimistic and down on the world, and I get a little fearful and less trusting of people. Mm-hmm. How about you? Now, very few teenagers are going to step forward and say, yeah, you know, that's actually the way I get too, Mom. Most of them are just going to right. sort of nod and walk away. But you've labeled something for them that's very important. And then you might hear that coming out on the phone 2 days later when they're talking to a friend, your words coming out of their mouth about the effects of television. But you have to be aware of
to
it. Fern is absolutely
seat.
Correct.
Fern, let me ask you, what do you think? Are American children being marinated in too much information right now?
Yeah, they definitely are. And I just had 2 additional things to say, which was that little kids who were watching the 9/11 events and subsequent events on television didn't realize they only happened once. They saw it over and over and over
yeah.
again
wow.
in the clips that were repeated, and they thought that buildings were being flown into again and again and again. That's one thing. The other thing is that there have been several studies done that I reported in my book, Terrorism and Kids, that show that there's a direct correlation in terms of children who watch terrorism and other traumatic events feel as if they have been present at those events. They're just as psychologically impacted as the people who actually were present at the event. So even though your child might not have been in New York during the 9/11 events, if they watch too much of it on television, they feel as though they were there.
Fern, yeah. thanks so much for calling in. Mike Riera, I want to put that to you. What about that lasting feeling of I was part of it? I suffered it.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think it's there, and parents can actually help to put a period on the end of this experience. And this is why ritual is so important in people's lives, and especially children's, that after an event like this, you know, the candle lighting ritual is very powerful. I remember sitting on my front steps with my five-year-old and some of our neighbors, and we were lighting candles and just being quiet for a moment. And even at five, she got that something important was happening.
You mean the evening that Americans were asked to go outside and show their hope with a candle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they get the sense that, okay, there's something I can do about this. I can't make it go away, but I can enter this and make something happen.
There's hope.
I'm not powerless to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not powerless to it. And I think one thing that Fern didn't mention that I wanted to add is images have the same effect as television. You know, a lot of the news magazines came out with the planes crashing into the tower right on the front page there. And I think those are very powerful, and sometimes we need to be careful that they're not sitting out all the time so the kids are seeing them every single time they walk by the coffee table in the living room, that we want to put them out of eyesight.
I will never forget watching my child's response to the Time magazine cover with the very angry Pakistani face on the front. It was visceral, and she smacked the magazine cover.
Jack, really?
Yeah, it was physical. Jack, I want to try to put this in a little perspective. This is not the first time that the world, that the United States, has seen trouble. There's always trouble. Do you feel a qualitative difference in this for kids?
Well, I think the media, a couple of points. I think the media makes it different. I mean, in World War II, for example, Americans didn't see a dead body until nearly 2 years into the war. Even the immediate newsreels from Pearl Harbor were scrubbed clean of bodies.
Is that right? No casualties were shown in the reels?
Life ran the first casualty late in 1943, and it was a big debate. One man dead on Buna Beach. And they
unimaginable today.
Unimaginable. So we're surrounded now with this, and the news has become toxic. I mean, it used to be, you know, mean world syndrome, this effect people get from watching the news. Now it's happening to even on the national news. That used to be a byproduct of watching, you know, the if it bleeds, it leads local news. Now the national news itself is toxic to consciousness and to the maintenance of its sort of childhood that balance between curiosity and innocence. I want to go back to a point that the doctor made, which was that it's so important, I think, to give children something to do, and since so many of these conflicts are just about hatred. I mean, when you really get down to it, hatred of other people, you can almost say to them, you know, you can make the world better by showing acceptance of the otherness of the other. You can make a gesture. You can go up to the kid who is excluded. You can go up to the kid who is different and say, I like you, or I'm curious about you. Or, in other words, in your own life, in your own school, you can make a difference in healing the kinds of hatred that causes this. You can be a kind of fighter against hatred.
Mike Riera, does that work?
I think it works wonderfully. I think it's a terrific point that Jack made. And one thing to remember about children is they have very active imaginations. And, you know, Bruno Bettelheim, the terrific psychiatrist last century, talked about that when children are raised, if reality is foisted on them too early and they lose their active imaginations, their imaginations become warped in later life. He actually felt that these are the people that become most susceptible to the influences of cults later on. What I think it means for our children is what Jack was saying, is we need to take their imaginations away from the terror and the evil after they get this basic information, and then put it onto the healing parts of it. You know, what else can you do to make it a safer place? What else can you do to meet different people, to see what it's like from different perspectives? Because this is where I think the creativity of children and teenagers, for sure, is sort of unsurpassed. As adults, we lose this. You know, we take the workshops about on the weekend about thinking outside the box all the time, and teenagers, for the most part,
do it naturally.
They live outside the box, and we're trying to get them back in. So let's make use of this in a positive way towards the healing and the promotion of well-being and getting along with people.
Listeners, what questions are your kids asking that stump you? What do you want to tell your kids that you don't know how to say? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jonathan is on the line. Welcome, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that I think TV nowadays is much more tame than it was in the 60s. I mean, I wasn't around then, except my parents tell me that there was so much gore on TV that they couldn't sit down and watch the news anymore.
Jonathan, do you think that TV's not gory today?
It is to some extent, except from what I hear from my elders is that it's much more tame than it was in the 70s.
And when you watch the evening news, and I mean, I guess even 9/11, does that rerun in your mind, Jonathan? Are you haunted like many adults are by the images of that day?
It does to some extent, except I think that maybe haunted is too strong of a word, except I think that we need to be reminded of it. We can't forget it.
What have your parents said to you about that?
Well, they sat down with me and they told me, they talked to me about it. They said, they asked me, what do you feel? And I think that it's important that the parents need to make it clear to the child that they can come to them and talk to them about anything they want, because if it's not clear to the child, then they may feel somewhat abandoned if they don't feel 100% mm-hmm. comfortable with going to their parent about anything they need.
How old are you, Jonathan?
I'm 17 right now.
Do you have a sense, just from what you read and see on TV and hear from adults, that the world is in tougher shape at the moment than it's been in the past or not?
Yeah, I actually do think it's in pretty tough shape right now. Everything that's going on here and in Israel, the Arab conflict, the Israeli-Arab conflict, I think that it's in a pretty tough shape, and I don't know what's going to happen.
Do you feel hopeful?
Yes. Sometimes no, though. I must admit, when I see sometimes back to the TV, when I see gore, what's happening, like in Israel, the suicide bombers, sometimes I do feel pretty hopeless, but, you know, it's less common. It's more common now, I mean, than it was before, but...
Mm-hmm. Mike Riera, stay with us, Jonathan, but Mike Riera, you can hear in Jonathan's mm-hmm. own description, he, you know, he sees that things are troubled at the same time. He is and wants to be hopeful.
Yeah, I think Jonathan is probably, if I were the parent of a 17-year-old, I'd feel terrific about where he is, because doesn't have his head in the sky and not looking at reality, but he's not stuck in it and mired in it to the point of losing his hope. And, you know, he's wrestling with some big issues. One of the things that we see this does, especially to adolescents like Jonathan, is it forces them to grow up much more quickly. You know, as parents, we imagine we could protect our kids. We can send them to high school, maybe even to college before they have to face the real world. This is definitely forcing them mm-hmm. to face the real world. He also said something that I think is very important to understand. His parents came to him and asked him questions. And one thing parents all need to remember is if your kids aren't asking you questions, it doesn't mean they're not worried. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not asking, we need to be coming to them periodically, because just, you know, there's a great psychiatrist last century named Harry Stack Sullivan, who in his therapy believed one of the jobs of the psychologist was to withstand the blow when people told you information that was hard to hear. For parents, we need to do the same thing. We need to withstand the blow of the questions our kids ask, but we need to also withstand the blow of their silence by asking them questions, you know, how you feel about this, if you thought more about this. For Jonathan's parents, about exploring a little bit his hopefulness and also exploring a little bit his hopelessness, because just a parent's presence and be willing to ask these questions is implicit in the implicit message is that you will get through this too.
Jonathan, do you welcome it when your parents ask what you're thinking?
Yeah, most of the time, actually.
Most of the time, right. Sometimes I'm sure it feels a little intrusive.
Yeah, obviously sometimes it does, except I think it's very important what they do, and that it's a necessity in parenting to be able to do that. And I also think before your comment that I think I was living a very sheltered life until 9/11, and it's really like a blast of reality. It really hit me in the face, like, wow, this can hit home. Mm-hmm. And it really, I think that it made me mature in so many ways. It really got me thinking.
Jonathan, we're all with you. Be brave, and thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Mike Riera, what about this issue of the sense of threat? 9/11 showed that the United States is not invulnerable. Do you see children living with a sense of real threat, of feeling, you know, fearful in their day-to-day environments?
You know, I don't necessarily see a real fearfulness in the day-to-day environments. I do see a little bit more where kids are a little bit more impatient than they've been in the past. Kids want to do this in their own time. They want to explore these issues in their own way. So sometimes schools, you know, in the best interest of the kids, have brought in speakers to talk about these issues. And for the most part, I would have to say those don't work so well because they're not on the kids' time frame. And kids want to talk about it when they want to talk about it. And it's usually a little bit sooner than the adults, and then they want to go on a big pause for a while, and then it's later again.
So you can't schedule the moment necessarily.
No, you can't schedule them. You know, you just can't walk them through it. You need to bring it up, and then as adults, you know, and this is where teachers, I think, are superb at being able to sense when kids are ready to talk about it. And it may happen in the middle of a novel that they're discussing in English class. All of a sudden, they realize the questions aren't about the novel anymore, but they're carrying an emotional weight that has more to do with September 11th or something else that's in the news.
Right.
And the savvy teachers can then turn this around and bring it back to what's really at point
it's
here.
It's coming right in. We're talking about talking to our kids. What do you want to tell your kids that you don't know how to say? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dan is on the line. Welcome, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Got a quick question / statement regarding the intermingling of trust and of paranoia in parents. And it stems back to a statement that was made earlier that if, especially in regards to the Catholic Church, if parents had properly prepared their children at the time, a lot of the things wouldn't have happened. And although I completely and totally agree with that, to play the devil's advocate for a moment, especially given the circumstances, especially given the time, you had parents who completely and totally trusted these sacred, holy figures.
And wanted to be able to, and wanted their kids to know that trust.
And the very conception that they would have to talk to their children about protecting themselves against, you know, these supposed animals, who at the time, of course, are these trusted figures, is a very difficult thing to believe and to conceive. And I guess, you know, coming from that premise and then moving onwards, now we're realizing that, well, maybe those beliefs, maybe that sense of trust was ill-found and may have led people astray.
And people have paid for it.
Right.
But you're pointing to something really important. Let me put it right to Mike, and thank you for your call, Dan. This issue, how do you sustain children's trust in fundamental humanity, goodness, trustworthiness of other people when you have to put all these caveats of warning on everything?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky one. I think, again, it's we are models for our kids in the way we get along with other people. And I think it means that we become transparent again in talking with our spouses and friends about what we like about them, how we know we can trust them, how they've stood by us in tough times, so that while we're talking about the outside world, somewhat abstract to kids, in home, what they're seeing in the relationships is people that can really trust one another. I think Dan brought up one incredible point about the parents of the kids who have gone through this, is to remember that was a time when we had complete trust in the priest. And in fact, there's a tragic irony there, is to imagine a priest not being trustworthy was probably a sin in the eyes of the Catholic Church. So the parents were really wrestling with some big things there. This has been a wake-up call for the parents as much as anyone, because we now see that there's no character that's automatically safe because of their profession and what's going on. And again, I think it comes back to the one-on-one relationship we have with our children and teaching them what they intuitively know about trusting people and not trusting people, helping them to articulate it, and then getting them to always trust their intuition. And that's one of the big things of integrity, is it's about being whole, and intuition is definitely a big piece of that.
We sure want our children to be whole, but there's a lot to wrestle with right now. We're talking about talking to our children tonight, talking to our children in difficult times about difficult subjects. What questions are your kids asking that stump you? Do you worry that your kids can't even ask what they want, what they need to know? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about talking to our kids in difficult times. Do you worry that your kids can't even ask what they want, what they need to know? What questions are your kids asking that stump you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking tonight with Mike Riera. He's author of Right from Wrong, Instilling a Sense of Integrity in Your Child. And Alvira is on the line. Welcome, Alvira. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sort of calling up with a perspective of being a senior citizen. I'm seeing World War II and all the bitterness.
Yep.
Having seen Pearl Harbor, having had relatives that were killed in Europe, having letters from them of starvation, having had worked very hard at that time, and raising I myself was raised never to be afraid to share. We as a family shared. We shared every experience, good and bad. Consequently, when I grew up, I raised my children that way.
When today, you say sharing, you mean being wide open about what's going on?
Wide open, but never, never in gory detail. Just reality. Mm-hmm. Being with them, talking to them at the dinner table. Most children today never have that time to have dinner with their children because everyone's off doing something different. And in my youth, we shared things together. So therefore, we weren't afraid. We trusted our parents.
I want to ask you, are you suggesting there that, in fact, despite all the TV and media, that children are in some way sheltered today?
I think a lot of children are sheltered. The reason I know that is because I also was a teacher, a high school teacher. Mm-hmm. I would know that children were sheltered. Many parents think that if they don't let their children know something, they're not going to learn about it. And children come back and learn from someone else and be very bitter about it.
Did learning the things that you learned about World War II make you cynical and hard-bitten, Alvira?
No, it did not. It gave me hope, which is an odd thing. I think our generation saw it as hope because we saw the world righted after that.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that happened after. My own children today, and I... are people who always, they're in their adult children.
Yeah.
They face the world with whatever comes up to them. It's useful in their marriage, on their job, wherever they are, because they never were sheltered.
They faced it head on. Mike Rayer, how about Alvira's perspective?
I think she's got a wonderful perspective. There's a couple things to underline there. First is they wouldn't go into the gory details. I think that's very important. And I think kids need to hear sometimes when their parents are sad, they're fearful, but they're also when they're excited, when they're hopeless, when they're full of hope. And one of the things that's important is I'm going to imagine in Alvira's family, they talked about it, they shared, and then they moved on with their life. It wasn't the sense that it became incapacitated and then became, why should we even bother kind of thing. That's important. And as a former teacher myself, I agree with what she's saying about kids is, it's not quite that they're sheltered, though. They hear these things either at home or they pick them up from their friends at school because it's just running around the playground all the time. And one of the things you see as a teacher is a lot of the kids don't know how to talk about these things. They don't have, you know, what's the popular phrase is emotional intelligence. They can articulate anger and rage and things like that, but they can't get into the variations of it, the fear, the suffering, the
because
sadness,
they haven't heard
the
it around the dining room table?
Some of it's because they haven't heard it around the dining room table, but some of it's just because we don't ask enough. We don't let them wrestle with these things. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, I think, in modern parenting, we try to, you know, in the name of self-esteem, we praise our kids a lot, and we don't let them struggle with some things they need to struggle. I mean, in Alvira's family, she had the experience of the adults and her brothers and sisters talking about difficult things to talk about. But implicit in this was that we can all handle this, and we'll get through it, and we'll take care of one another. And that's powerful. That's a very powerful message to send to kids.
Alvira, thank you so much for your call. Jack Beattie, I want to turn to you on this. You know, there are all these big issues today, and they all sound so global and potentially apocalyptic, global warming, global terror, global hatred. Many adults today grew up with the threat of nuclear apocalypse in the air, but shy of that, there was a sense in many households, certainly in mine, of this deep of abiding faith in the fundamental goodness of humanity. Is that somehow being eaten away, Jack?
I don't know. I mean, I think it must be very hard for children to reconcile what they hear in church and what they hear from their parents with the world as it is, where in politics, you know, in our values and in religion, we tend to talk about right and wrong. But in politics, especially in international politics, it's much more tragic than that. It's right and right. And I think that if you can sort of understand, in other words, the child could easily feel that all his categories are helpless and can't make sense of this world.
Mm-hmm.
I think parents need to say, well, there's this other category here of politics where you do have right conflicting with right. In Israel, they have a right to exist. The Palestinians have a right to their country. The means are terrible on both sides, but these are collisions of right, which makes it tragic because right is destroyed in the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very important so that they don't think that the verities they're learning are
meaningless.
They're meaningless. They're meaningful in the personal life,
mm-hmm.
not in the political world.
Mike Riera, what about this notion that there are many things that people get alarmed about these days, and some of them they probably should be alarmed about. Mm-hmm. How do you balance a sense of alarm about some really big issues with the cultivation of a sense of abiding confidence?
Well, I think Jack said it quite well. You talk about the political and the global and what's going on with the world, but you also bring it back to the personal. And, you know, most schools now have programs about conflict resolution, about how, helping kids take two rights and figure out a way that they can both live with each other and work it through in some way. And it's in the details of things like this, and we have to remind our kids of how they're working through things, of the good things that are happening to them in school. And not that we're fabricating for them, but we're asking them questions about some of these things that happened in them. And we're pointing out to them some of the qualities they have. It could be, you know, in the game, the referee made a bad call, but I saw you wince, but you hung in there, you kept trying, you didn't let it get you down. How did you do that? That seems like an important quality to have. And this is where, in a strange way, we're almost like anthropologists to our kids' experiences. We're pointing out the moments they're having that they may not recognize, because all this helps them, and, you know, it's a 90s buzzword, to feel empowered in their lives. And when they feel that strength, they're much more able to then look at the global and the political and what's going on and not get knocked over by it. But we can't protect them from it either.
David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I want to get back a little bit to what you were saying earlier about this fundamental faith in humanity that we've been told existed in generations prior. I'm in my 20s. I wasn't alive back then, certainly. But looking back, I mean, it was pretty bad. I mean, you guys had race riots. There was segregation. There was the Red Scare all in the 50s. You know, women had
absolutely
so few rights in the home. And it seems like there's this continual whitewashing of, you know, this golden era when people were nice to each other, and now is so bad.
Oh, but that's a different thing, isn't it? There's always been trouble and woe. But somehow in the media bath, I guess the concern I was raising was, does a fundamental abiding hope and faith that lives beneath the woe go on? There was sure enough plenty of woe to go around then. But you're saying, David, that this isn't necessarily the worst of times. There's always been trouble.
Of course. And one of the great things that a sense of historical perspective can give you is that in any given era, people feel it's the worst of all times. I mean, you can take this back to Chaucer's time. You know, this is a civilization in England that just got over the Black Death, and they're saying, you know, oh gosh, this is surely a sign of the apocalypse. And here we are, you know.
It does come back again and again.
But I think a sense of perspective is something that we understandably lose when we're in a period of, you know, of pain and turmoil. But
it's a worthy point. David, thanks for your call. Mike Riera, are we keeping enough perspective? Are we making up the notion that our children have special challenges today?
To some degree, yes. To some degree, no. It's a different world than it was then. I think it goes back to a phrase that Jack used earlier, the word toxic. And I think one of the things we have to watch with our kids is that we don't inadvertently, in the name of wanting to be informed with all that's going on, create a toxic world for our kids, whether this is leaving newspapers around that show these terrorist acts right on the front page and our kids are seeing it all the time, whether it's having the news on television all the time on the 24-hour station, whether it's always in the radio having news about what's going on in the world. Sometimes we need to give our kids a break and just have music in the background, give them a little escape. And that's one of the ways I think that kids will get through this time. And whatever we say in this generation, the next generation is going to say it's worse then. And it's sort of always been the case that we do this generation by generation.
Mike Riera, you're very, very generous with your time tonight, and we thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Mike Riera is co-author of the new book, Right from Wrong, Instilling a Sense of Integrity in Your Child. For more of Mike Riera's advice, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, you feeling more confident? You feeling like our kids can perk up and deal with it?
Well, listening to young men like David and Jonathan, that gives me a lot of hope.
Perks me right up. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Up next, how the news has changed the way one woman hears a knock on the door. This is On Point. Friday in a New Hampshire courtroom. Two teenage boys pleaded guilty of charges related to the stabbing deaths of two Dartmouth College professors in January last year. The murders of Hoff and Suzanne Zantop spread fear around the Dartmouth, New Hampshire campus, and news reports detailing the crime shook many people around the country. In this diary, Karen Round of Linfield, Massachusetts, says that these news stories have changed the way she feels about unexpected knocks on the front door.
I didn't think much about it. Someone knocked. I saw someone I didn't know, a man wearing a baseball cap. I opened the door. My car broke down, he said, or words to that effect. He asked to use our phone. They all asked to use the phone. That's why we have a cordless phone upstairs. My family and I live in a suburban house across the street from an entrance and exit ramp to an interstate highway near Boston. In the 11 years that we've lived here, we've opened our door to many people whose cars have broken down. The man on the porch was merely the most recent. Actually, he was more than that. He was the first person to knock on our door since I found out why the Dartmouth College professors were killed. They had let strangers into their house. All sorts of stranded people have knocked on our door. A man in a business suit, guys pushing motorcycles, a young woman dressed for work rather than for the growing snowstorm, a bedraggled man who left his wife with their car, and that night, minutes later, a young girl alone in another car. A woman who spoke in the lilting cadences of India or maybe Pakistan knocked once, and another time it was a man whom I took to be a Sikh because of his turban and the silver bracelet on his wrist. He and I also had trouble understanding each other, but I gathered that he called someone on my phone to get directions to New York City before he returned to the 18-wheeler parked out front. And this is just the partial list. I was only frightened once when a pair of men knocked on the door late at night when I was home alone with our kids. I didn't let them in. Eventually, more details about the Zantop slayings were made public. The newspapers reported that the two teenagers first tried to enter other houses. One ruse that didn't work, because the man who answered the door carried a gun, was that their car had broken down. I've never been unmindful of risk. When my kids were very little, and when each stranger's knock on the door still surprised me, safety was all I thought about. It took time, and being stranded in the car once myself, to shift my sympathies. Plus, I read a lot. Ralph Waldo Emerson, my favorite mentor, wrote that anyone who wants to walk in the most peaceful parts of life with any serenity must screw himself up to resolution. Well, that's what I was trying to do, be resolute. I just didn't know it at the time. But the Zantop slayings gave me pause. That is why, in hindsight, it surprises me that I opened the door to the man in the baseball cap without giving it much thought. I just did what I've always done. I'll get you the cordless, I told him, but I'm on my way out. I left the door open and fetched it and a couple of telephone books. Then I asked him to leave the phone behind the screen door when he was done. He was flipping through the yellow pages as I closed the door. I still read Emerson for comfort and maybe courage. Let him front the object of his worst apprehension, he wrote, and his stoutness will commonly make his fear groundless. These days I take those words as a prescription for all of us. Every time we get on a plane, or ride to the top of a skyscraper, or even help a stranger. When we fortify ourselves, we defy those who would rather we lived in fear. By the time I returned to our house later on, the man was gone, the phone books lay where I'd put them, and the telephone was propped between our front doors. I knew he'd been there, but nothing much had changed.
Karen Round lives in Linfield, Massachusetts. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Sam Sodikson, Darren Manoogian, Tim Skog, Mike Garth, and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is W.